Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here, and I've really benefited already from the discussions over the last day. So I'm looking. I have to speak up. Sorry. I was just saying thank you, and thank you very much to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to be here and to be a part of these discussions. We're often confronted in our work at Human Rights Watch with questions that might be considered to be a part of the larger discourse on transitional justice, because we're so often pressing for accountability for the mass atrocities that we're documenting in our work. And we're often pressing for accountability at times that can be considered inconvenient by other actors. But we're not transitional justice experts. But what we thought we could perhaps contribute to this discussion of peace and justice is to pull together the observations that we've made in the last two decades of human rights monitoring and also monitoring of these international justice processes and justice processes in other fora, to see what kinds of themes emerge, what the facts that we've collected and the observations that we've made over the years can show. So what we've done, we've done that, in fact, and the product is a report that we'll be releasing in about 2 weeks. I wasn't able, because it wasn't completely finalized, to include it in the conference materials. But for those of you who are interested, I'll make sure that you're able to get a copy. And the title of the report is Selling Justice Short, Why Justice Matters for Peace. And so what I'll try to do here this afternoon is highlight some of these main themes. Before I go further, I think I should make clear that this report is the product of research conducted by my colleagues over geographic periods, over time periods. So I'm by no means an expert in the examples in the report or the few examples I'll cite today. And in fact, I think many of these cases will be more familiar to some of you. So I would be actually very interested if our assessment matches with yours, and I can take it back to my colleagues and we can continue this discussion. But I hope I can just kind of give you a sense of what to expect from the report. It seems to us that what is a long-running discussion about justice and peace, or whether justice interferes with prospects for peace, or maybe in the language of this plenary, whether justice should yield to the political goal of peace, has heated up now that the possibility of leaders being brought to trial for atrocities is increasingly becoming a reality. That the International Criminal Court operates while conflicts are ongoing, we think probably adds fuel to the intensity of this debate. And the temptation to suspend justice in exchange for promises to end a conflict or to negotiate transition has already arisen with respect to at least three of the four situations under investigation by the ICC. So the debate is sharpening up, but meanwhile, the context is changing. On the one hand, with the functioning of international criminal courts and the increasing resort to universal jurisdiction and other means through which the prosecution of serious international crimes is becoming more common, it's now generally recognized that there is this obligation to prosecute these crimes. And we talked this morning about what that's meant for the amnesty discussion. So the expectation of victims is changing in this context. And on the other hand, in the few years since the ICC has become operational, diplomats tasked with negotiating peace agreements have often been heard to argue that the prospect of prosecution has made their jobs more difficult, and that facing understandable pressure to end conflict, they must push justice to the side. And affected communities, if they're consulted in these peace processes, are asked, what do you prefer, peace or justice? In the short term, it's certainly easy to understand the temptation to forego justice. And there are undoubtedly many factors that influence the resumption of conflict. We don't assert that impunity is the sole causal factor. But what we're trying to do with this report is to show that in research in a number of different countries and a number of different time periods, that the impact of justice is often undervalued in weighing up objectives in resolving a conflict. As it turns out, in practice, the anticipated negative consequences of pressing for accountability often don't come to pass. And on the flip side, ignoring atrocities can carry a high price. One part of our report really looks at two points in time. One is at the moment of negotiating peace, and one is later. What are the longer term effects? That that set of longer-term effects maybe is of more interest, in a sense, to the transitional justice discussions. But I'm going to talk here about this heat of the moment at the time of peace negotiation. As a colleague said to me at lunch, I think it's not unconnected, because, of course, what comes out of the peace process can so often shape whether it's possible, what transitional justice mechanisms are possible, whether it's possible to grandfather back in accountability. So I'm going to focus on the three ways in which our research suggests that justice is undervalued in peace talks. First, insisting on justice doesn't necessarily end peace talks. For example, in May of 1999, we have the ICTY issuing its indictment against Milosevic and four others for crimes in Kosovo. The indictment was announced in the midst of armed conflict between Serbia and NATO forces over Kosovo, and the conventional wisdom was that it would make the situation in Kosovo worse, and it would likely undercut the prospects of any compromise by Milosevic. And Milosevic himself was very contemptuous of the indictment and vowed that he would never face trial in The Hague. But it was only a week later that negotiators announced that Milosevic had accepted the terms of an international peace plan for Kosovo. And despite their strong opposition at the time, intermediaries involved in the process, Russian and Finnish intermediaries, have it since admitted that the indictment never was on the agenda of the negotiations and did not affect them in any way. So we're not suggesting with this example that it was an inducement to talks, but that it was not, it was just a non-factor. Milosevic, of course, eventually lost the presidential contest and was forced to concede defeat, and 6 months later was arrested and transferred, even after that, to The Hague. That's one example. The second point that we're making is that sometimes these indictments, criminal justice processes, can actually lead to the stigmatization and marginalization of actors that can then ultimately facilitate peace agreements, even stability. And the second half of the Milosevic story is perhaps part of an example of that. Another example is that of Charles Taylor. The unsealing of the arrest warrant for Charles Taylor at the opening of talks to end the Liberian Civil War has now ultimately been viewed as helpful in moving negotiations forward. It delegitimized Taylor both domestically and internationally, and it made clear that he would have to leave office, and this had been a sticking point in the negotiations. He left Liberia a few months later. We can also see maybe some similar effects when it comes to the Juba process that Barney Afeko was just describing. It's an enormously complicated situation, and judging by the number of times it appears on the program and in discussions, one that I think you're all very familiar with. And it's certainly one without a clear ending. So I think any claim of a positive effect has to be very modest when we have crimes continuing by the LRA, when we have very little progress towards reconstruction in northern Uganda, when we have no accountability for either side. But it seems that the ICC arrest warrants, once issued, were a factor in isolating support for the LRA from Khartoum. It's one of the hoped-for consequences, perhaps not hoped for in the way that we would desire. In fact, it does seem to have come to pass. There are other factors, of course, the CPA, and the resolution of the North-South conflict in Sudan lessened the value of the LRA to Khartoum as a proxy. But analysts have suggested that another consideration was Khartoum's concern that it would be implicated in the LRA crimes. The warrants also brought a level of attention to the conflict in northern Uganda that was unprecedented. And this attention may have helped to attract the resources that were necessary for the Juba talks. Although, again, a final agreement wasn't reached. And the issue of the ICC warrants also ensured that there was a place for accountability discussions at the table in Juba, leading to both consultations in the country about accountability and about what it should look like, and also the conclusion of an agreement that would have provided for national prosecutions in a special division of the Ugandan High Court. That agreement remains unsigned, but actors are using that agreement as a basis to push for this special division in Uganda and to extend its mandate so it's not just focused on LRA crimes, but also on state crimes. Third, and the final argument, is that foregoing accountability doesn't necessarily offer the hoped-for benefits. We had some of this discussion this morning when we were talking about amnesties and about how down the road amnesties may not end conflict, but also may have some trickle-on effects in terms of understanding about the rule of law. But I want to talk about, not about amnesties, but where war criminals are incorporated into a government as part of a peace settlement. And the example I'll use is that of Congo. A pervasive culture of impunity has been one of the greatest obstacles to sustainable peace in Congo. There are many others, but we really believe in our research, and we've really seen that this is one of them. It's in an effort to buy compliance with the transition process at the end of the 1998-2003 war in Congo. The government gave posts of national or local responsibility, including in the army and police, to dozens of people suspected of committing human rights violations. The negative consequences of this is perhaps has been most evident in Ituri, which has often been described as the bloodiest corner of Congo. In December 2004, despite mounting evidence of their abuses, Kabila signed a decree granting five leaders of Ituri armed groups positions as generals in the newly integrated Congolese army, and a number of other militiamen as well, positions at a slightly lower level. The Congolese authorities contended that integrating these commanders with abusive records was a way of removing them from Ituri, thus making it easier to end the fighting there. But by doing so, the government reinforced the message that brutalities would not only go unpunished, but might actually be rewarded with a government post. The message was clear: violence brings rewards, and the message was heard. Within 6 months of the appointments, new armed groups were formed in Ituri, all claiming, as the others had done before, that they represented marginalized communities and demanding high ranks in the army. These groups continued the terror tactics that previous armed groups had used so successfully. In May 2006, one of these groups, the FNI, killed a UN peacekeeper and took seven others hostage. As part of negotiations to free the peacekeepers, the FNI's leader, Peter Karim, demanded a position as general in the Congolese army. And according to a UN official involved in the negotiations, he was actually given verbal assurances that a high-ranking position would be offered to him. This set the direction for another round of promoting warlords to positions of power. In August 2006, a couple of months later, Congolese government officials, supported by the UN, once again held peace discussions with the Ituri groups. 2 months later, the group signed a new peace agreement, and their leaders, including Peter Karim, were all granted the rank of colonel in the Congolese army. Dozens of others were appointed to the positions of lieutenant colonels and majors. One of the newly appointed officers later remarked to Human Rights Watch, "Maybe if we had killed more people, I would have become a general." At times, Congolese judicial officials, with the help of UN human rights specialists, did try to stem the wave of impunity, but their efforts have often been undermined by political interference, by corruption, sometimes just by prison breaks. And the ongoing impunity has left alleged war criminals free to continue to commit crimes. And one of these is Bosco Ntaganda. Ntaganda's track record is one of widespread human rights abuses, and since 2006, he's been wanted by the ICC. He should be sitting in the dock side by side with his co-defendant Thomas Lubanga, whose trial is going on right now in The Hague. But not once, but twice, in 2004 and again this year, he's been rewarded with a high-ranking position in the army. He didn't take it the first time. In January, Kabila held a nationally televised press conference to claim that this was necessary. He invoked the justice peace dilemma to justify Bosco's promotion. But the decision has been condemned not just internationally, but by dozens and dozens of local human rights groups. They know that it will only serve to reinforce the perception that those who commit heinous crimes against civilians in Congo will be rewarded rather than punished. The strategy has not worked to end cycles of violence in eastern DRC. It seems unreasonable to us to expect that it would do so now. So those are the three main ways that we discuss in our report, and again, this is just one part of the report, about how foreclosing the possibility of justice at any rate, even if specific arrangements for justice are not made at the peace table, doesn't end, and having justice be an issue doesn't necessarily end peace talks. It can sometimes marginalize actors and clear the way for political settlements. and that sacrificing justice doesn't necessarily have the hoped-for benefits when it comes to peace. I want to be clear that although this report argues in those ways that justice is shortchanged and that the cost of overlooking impunity is high, we acknowledge that there's no formula, no one formula, maybe not even any formula for all situations. Well-known counterexamples do exist, including Mozambique and Angola, where it seems that amnesties have not thus far led to renewed violence, at least the most recent amnesty in Angola. There's a very real danger of oversimplification, and what we're trying to do is put what we've seen in our monitoring on the table and not to suggest that there aren't real tensions between peace and justice. It's our view, though, that law and international practice has evolved in the last 15 years to the point where both peace and justice should be the objectives of negotiations and aimed at ending a conflict. The task we see it then is how to manage this tension. And again, we don't have all the answers. We're just really trying to put on the table and make sure that these discussions are fully informed. To maybe just conclude by trying to tie my remarks back to the theme of the plenary, which is it all just politics? I mean, justice, particularly international justice, operates on a political landscape. I completely agree with the other two presenters on this panel. And it's a landscape that's undeniably uneven when it comes to the prosecution of international crimes. There are jurisdictional constraints on the ICC. There's a lack of political will in national jurisdictions and in other bodies. So this political landscape creates very real challenges. Some challenges have to be met by the justice mechanisms themselves. They must proceed even-handedly. They have to investigate all sides. They have to clearly explain their mandate, the limits of that mandate, in a manner that leaves little room for distortion and the appearance of political manipulation. Other challenges need to be met by the states themselves and the international community as a whole, building political support, providing international cooperation, prosecuting these crimes, putting laws in place to do so. I think the point our research can make is not to deny then an interaction between justice and politics, but that rather, in the context of peace processes, politics can and should be constrained by a concern that justice be done, and an understanding that it neither dooms these peace talks to failure, and that the price of leaving justice out can be high. I think if we do otherwise, we risk a few things. We risk turning our back on the expectations of victims. We may fail to capture some of the benefits of trials, including as protection against revisionism. And bit by bit, I think we might undermine the chance that a credible, consistent, and predictable system of international criminal justice for mass atrocities can deter future crimes. This, of course, was an aspiration of the establishment of the Rome system. It's likely to be years before the ICC has established a track record and developed its standing as an effective institution such that it can have or claim to have any kind of deterrent value. We have some anecdotal evidence that there is a certain amount of effect coming out of the ICC's first prosecution. On the day Thomas Lubanga was transferred from the ICC to the DRC, on child soldiering charges, our researchers had a meeting with a Congolese army colonel to discuss crimes committed by his forces against the Mai Mai, a local militia. As the discussion turned to war crimes, the colonel sat up and said, "I don't want to be like Lubanga. I don't want to be transferred to The Hague." And this is not the only conversation our researchers have had. In a September 2006 discussion with a militia leader in Ituri, who was at the time engaged in peace negotiations with the Congolese government, the commander asked Human Rights Watch for further information about what constituted war crimes, having heard a broadcast from The Hague about proceedings the day before. When the elements of the crimes were explained to him, he asked, "So could I be transferred to The Hague if I did those things?" And when informed that if he had done such things, that was a possibility, he put his head in his hands and he said, I had no idea. And we've had similar conversations in the Central African Republic as well. So I don't want to overstate the significance of these anecdotes, but I thought maybe I could leave it there to suggest that it's a start, and it's perhaps the kernel of something that we should keep in mind when political expediency might beckon in a different direction.